Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am your host, Neil Blackman. Eric Fawcett's going to join me on this episode. We'll talk Florida's heartbreaking loss to Kentucky. We will also break down and preview Florida's road game against, at least for now, number 22 Ole Miss as we record on Sunday night. Expect the Rebs to drop out of the rankings after getting shellacked at Tennessee over the weekend, but that probably makes them an angry team. And obviously, Florida fans are familiar with Chris Beard, the excellent coach, at least as a basketball coach. He's tremendous as a human. We don't need to get into that too much, but the bottom line is he's leading Ole Miss now, which makes him a formidable opponent. And, going to be a tough one for the Gators in Oxford, coming off a heartbreaker at home in a tremendous environment at the Odom. If you were there, pat yourself on the back. Absolutely electric building. Unfortunate Florida couldn't close it out, but a great basketball game. If you're a fan of the sport, and if you're listening, we know you are. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show. Florida Basketball Hour podcast is brought to you by the Gatorverse, an exclusive community dedicated to connecting University of Florida fans and student athletes. Members receive access to exclusive autograph collectibles, real-life experiences, giveaways, VIP events, rewards, and athletes receive a majority of revenue from sales of their collectibles. That's the way that NIL is supposed to work. To find out more about becoming a Gatorverse member and Locker Mania, visit Gatorverse.io. That's Gatorverse.io. Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, I'll be joined by Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com. We're going to break down Florida's heartbreaking 87-85 defeat to Kentucky on Saturday afternoon in the Odom. Just a really, really good game, high-level college basketball game. Tremendous environment. Everything you could want. Sean Kelly on the call. He's a great, great basketball play-by-play guy. Jay Billis as your analyst. Rowdies were in their seats at whenever they opened the door, 10:45 or whatever it is, 11 a.m. I don't know. Hour 90 minutes before tip, I guess. They're in there. Or 2 hours before, so 10:30. Rowdies were there, 10:30. Students were there. All student seats filled, 11:30. It was loud pretty much throughout the game. The first Go Big Blue chant that was decipherable came at 79-76 Kentucky, unfortunately, with about 45. I don't know. There was a couple minutes to play, I guess, when Bradshaw hit the three. But, yeah, I mean, another missed opportunity for Florida. Gators still lack a quad one win. Got to kind of get that out there 90 seconds into the show, unfortunately, Eric. No moral victories. Just kind of that was the comment Zion Pullen made to the press. And hard to disagree.
Yeah, I think it's one of those games that is kind of funny in the sense that, like, if you would have just looked at the reaction to the game from fans, from media to some extent, and you would think that this was some crushing loss, or maybe it was like late in the season. And then when you kind of take a step back, it's like, well, Ken Pom had this game off by 1 point, almost nailed the exact score. It's one of those things that's like, was it a game that Florida should have won? No, not necessarily. Is it a game that Kentucky should have won by a lot? No, not necessarily. It's kind of just like exactly what happened is what could have been expected. But it just seems that, like, again, when you put together the record that the Gators have in the last two seasons against top 50 KenPom teams or in quad one games, whatever you want to say, it just seems like when the Gators just cannot get it done against a good team, those wins become those losses become a little bit louder. So that's like kind of the two ways you can take this game, whether it's a glass half full or a glass half empty thing, or how how much you want to zoom in on this exact performance. Like if you zoom in on this exact performance, well, the Gators played well and got edged out by a better team that's better by the metrics. If you want to take a grander zoom out, you would say, okay, like once again, the Gators cannot beat a good team, despite the fact that that team is still pretty thin in the front court and a team that was super reliant on shooting the three, didn't shoot the ball well. Like things broke the Gators' way in a couple of fashions. But yeah, it's just if the Gators had shown the ability over their last 2 years, but you could say, or even this year, to just win a good game, I think a lot of people would say like, well, this is a tough loss, happens. But it just seems like a lot of built up frustration was the reaction.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And that was kind of, I mean, my reaction was a little bit of both. I mean, on the one hand, Florida led Kentucky for 30 minutes, and we at least got one like sort of Cal coach speak phrase that only Cal puts out there where he was like, hey, we got lucky. You know, we out rebounded them 40-43. And he felt like that was winning the rebounding battle because of how well Florida rebounds. And he said, you know, we kind of got lucky. They missed a layup in transition in the second half. They had some open threes in the second half. They just didn't hit. Their best shooter went, I think he said over 10, but it was over 9. You know, so there were some things. Like if you had said before the game that Florida would get 3 points from Tyrese Samuel and pretty much absolutely nothing from Will Richard, I would have thought that Florida was in deep, deep trouble. And instead they led for 30 minutes. But they led Wake Forest for 22. You know, they didn't lead Baylor for very long. So that game was a little bit different because Florida kind of played the Kentucky role against Baylor, where Baylor just couldn't pull away because every time Baylor seemed like they were going to pull away, Florida made a run. But Baylor, you know, unlike the Gators with 1 and 2 possession leads, would score. And so Florida could never trim that gap, and Kentucky managed to get back in it. You know, I thought the most costly segment of the game was the first 4 minutes of the second half. You know, I thought Florida coming out and losing that segment by 8 points and having their lead completely erased at the first media timeout was really bad. And honestly, the first minute of the second half was disastrous. I mean, it was 4 Kentucky points and then a Florida turnover. So Kentucky had the ball to make it a 1-possession game with 19 minutes left in the half.
Yeah, you could certainly say that one. I think confidence-wise, to just take maybe, I mean, it didn't really take that much steam out of the crowd. The crowd was really good throughout, but it took a little bit of that momentum. Like things were completely rolling for the Gators. At the same time, if you would have told me, and I didn't hear, what you're saying is probably the right answer. I'm looking at I think it was about 3:30 to, you know, with left in the second half to like 40 seconds left when the Gators went up with a couple of free throws. And then on the next 4 possessions, the Gators went 0-3 plus a turnover. And I think on 2 of those possessions, they didn't make a single pass before taking a shot. Kentucky scores on 3 of 4 possessions and suddenly, you know, Kentucky's won the game. They're up by 5. Of course there were still some free throws afterwards and Zion Pullen got downhill for some quick twos when Kentucky was taking away the three. But like, to me, it's the late game execution where the Gators have, again, if this was one game that where the Gators have proven they could kind of get anything done in crunch time, you'd say, oh, you know, it happens. But like, here's a situation where the Gators on 4 straight possessions at the biggest moment of the game could not get a single good look. It was 3. Well, I'll say 2 bad shots, 1 okay shot and a turnover in the 4 biggest possessions of the game. So
right.
That would have been maybe my vote for most important, but I mean, it's also maybe unfair to say, cause I feel like every single game you could look at the last couple of minutes and those possessions are amplified, but like this is just a game where you still even when the Gators had their lead evaporate, in the stage you were talking about to start the second, it still like kind of felt like the Gators had some control. Oh man, in crunch time, there was, you know, there's no question who had control. It was not the Gators. So Neil, like what do you have to say about another dry offensive finish in a close game for the Gators?
Yeah, I mean, Florida, you know, and we talked about how Florida's improved offensively, and I think we saw it again in the first half. Good ball movement. Zion Poland playing really, really under control, and then Florida exploiting some things that Kentucky was doing wrong in their ball screen defense. And so I think, you know, the Gators were able to execute, but down the stretch, it has consistently been a problem. And it doesn't, and now we've seen it with multiple different groups of sort of players on the floor too, Eric, where like Florida's had different fives, whether it was the end of the Wake Forest game or the end of the Kentucky game. You know, I thought maybe one of Florida's possessions, there was kind of an unfortunate like turnover and then a foul called on Kugel. And I thought the Kentucky player, this was the one that was like right in front of me from the press. Like it's pretty clear that he just fell out of bounds. Like I'm not sure what Kugel did that warranted a call, but I think also in like that kind of physical tussle when Kentucky comes away with the ball, like 9 times out of 10, a referee is going to blow their whistle and just call something and not just say, oh, it's Florida's ball. And then I wouldn't have trusted Florida to necessarily run anything great off the inbound play anyway. So, you know, I think that's a problem. But yeah, Florida just has not executed offensively down the stretch in critical games, in critical junctures of games, and their opponents have. And so, you know, that's been kind of the difference in 3 of Florida's 4 losses. I won't say the Baylor game really, because that was the one game where it was really about Florida's inability to get stops. But in 3 of Florida's 4 losses, all games that were very, very winnable, you know, it really comes down to Florida's inability to run good stuff or execute the stuff that they have in their playbook.
Yeah, that's what I have to wonder too. Like again, I did not like the shot that Zion Poland took. In a little bit of just like an isolation leaner. And does he have the ability to take those mid-range shots and make them? Like, yes, certainly. But he just went up without manipulating the defense whatsoever, without the ball moving side to side. He just like he was like, I'm getting a shot up here. And maybe to some extent, there's going to be times where Florida needs that from Poland, who I think has shown the ability to do that. But I just have to wonder, was that the game plan, or was that a guy who thought he was going to take control of this thing? Was this a guy who did not trust whatever was being ran? Because again, if there was some flares losing trust in what was being called at the end of games, like that would be understandable. Like, did he think that truly that Florida's best chance at scoring in that moment was him going and forcing a tough two? I don't know, but that was again, like that's a guy who I think that we have generally liked his decision-making throughout the course of games and makes really good reads. And I don't want to say this was a selfish shot necessarily, but I would just say that generally he plays unselfishly. And when you know, go up and without passing, take a tough two, like that just doesn't look great. And the results are great. Yeah. What do you got, Neil?
No, I got a take on that. Cause that, you know, again, right in front of me. So I think what happened there was Clayton gets across midcourt and there was clearly Clayton, Zion made a kind of irritated face before he drove. And what he was irritated about was there was a pin down and Clayton did not cut. So Walter Clayton is not in the right spot. And by the time he gets out there, Kentucky had it guarded and you could see Zion get irritated. And I think he just kind of, you know, again, this is just what I saw. It seemed like he was frustrated and just kind of was like, all right, fine. I'll just do it myself. Which that's not good. That's not good. But I think it started because Florida had something to try to get Walter Clayton to look, and Clayton either didn't understand what they were trying to do or missed it because it was loud and frenetic or whatever. But there was clearly an action that was supposed to be run that was not run. That led to Zion taking that shot, which I agree was, you know, certainly not what Florida wanted on that play.
Yeah, I think I'm just, as you were talking, I've went to go pull it up and I'm just going through free throws at the end of the game. But yeah, watching it again, and you know, not to narrate this, but yeah, like you said, I mean, Pullen is dribbling and pointing 4 guys into position, and then it looks like there's a little bit of a Spain ball screen, and then It wasn't quite as bad as described. It wasn't quite an isolation. There was a little bit of a Spain ball screen, but it looked like it was, he's trying to point everyone into position. Guys were getting pushed to the opposite side of the floor. So it's clearly, things clearly went awry. And again, it's just not a great look given Florida's poor history of late game execution. So I think that's got to be one of the just kind of major takeaways for me. Like, again, I my response to this game is a little bit of, you know, yin and yang, where there's part of me that I'm like, hey, like, they lost a close game to a team that's really good. I don't think Kentucky is the sixth best team in the country, as their AP poll number suggests, but I think that they're, you know, really good and really talented.
Yeah, they're Sweet 16 and, good, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And especially if they get their center eligible, because and we could maybe talk about the front court advantage that wasn't for Florida, or whatever you want to say. I'll throw that to you after. But again, this would be my, like, realistic yet pessimistic. Like, it's like almost optimistic, it's almost pessimistic. But again, my optimistic take would be, again, Florida lost to a team that was 18th in KenPom by 2 points, mm-hmm. in a game that they were supposed to lose by KenPom. So, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. So on one hand, that's my optimistic view. Hey, it's not like the Gators had some crushing defeat to an awful team. However, my pessimistic take would be, okay, Florida was playing the 18th ranked KenPom team. They entered the game ranked 35th in KenPom. And right when they lost and the score was updated, Florida stayed at 35. They're now at 37 because of some other games that have happened since. We're recording on Sunday night. But at the time, it was one of those games where it's like Florida played about exactly like we said, KenPom was 1 point off nailing the exact score of this game. So Florida played about exactly as they should have.
Yep.
So the pessimistic side of that is they played like the 35th best team in the country. And that, I think, is my pessimistic takeaway, is just look at KenPom's ranking for the Gators. So they started the year 39th, you know, lose to Virginia. They only drop one spot to 40. They're 41, 41, 35 after the win against Florida State. They play Baylor really tough. They go up to 28. Then, you know, they start to play Merrimack, Richmond, 35, 31, 30. Then it's the Michigan game, 38, 36, 34 after Quinnipiac, 35 going into Kentucky. They lose that game. They stay at 35. Like, go look at a random team and look at how much they fluctuate in non-conference play early. Like, teams are all over the place. Like, I could go to Michigan, who was like high 30s, low 70s, and now they're, you know, settling. Florida has just shown over and over and over again that they're like the 35th best team in the country. And I know a lot of people think they're better than that, but it's just like, look at their performances. Like, everything, whether it's like gutting out a win against Michigan, whether it's losing a tough one to Kentucky, whether it's just losing a tough one to Virginia, like the everything just points to Florida being like the 35th best team in the country. And that is, to me, extremely disappointing relative to the talent on the roster and what the expectation should be of Florida given the circumstances. So it's like, that's kind of my two takeaways from Florida playing exactly as well as they should have against Kentucky. They didn't play badly. They didn't do anything they shouldn't have, but they have proven once again that they're a mid 30s KenPom team, which is super bubblicious.
But I mean, I think Florida is getting better. And I say that cautiously, because we just talked about the same sort of systemic problem at the end of games that's happened three times. I think in the middle of games, they're getting better. Their offensive efficiency is slightly better, but I think that they're executing stuff better. I think Riley Kugel showed, especially in the first half, that he's at least embraced coming off the bench. We'll see if he can start to limit the turnovers. He had another couple late game turnovers that were pretty costly for Florida. One, I thought it's unfortunate that the turnover gets charged to Kugel, because, you know, I mean, it hit Condon in the hands. You know, he should probably catch that pass. And I, you know, at press level, you could hear Condo say, my bad, my bad. So, you know, it's not like Alex was shocked that the ball came to him. But yeah, I mean, the point being, like, there's still execution stuff with Riley. He's the guy who missed the transition layup. That was pretty costly. Florida could have gone up. I think that would have put him up back up by four at 78-74, I think. So, you know, it might have been a little earlier than that. Either way, upsetting to kind of have that kind of opportunity and miss it. And so I think they're getting better. But then Eric makes this good point about kind of, are they the 34th, 35th best team in the country? So, like, so people know, like, Billy Donovan, 16 and 17, last team, 34th in KenPom. Like, just the most unlucky team in history, maybe, in Florida history. Like, they lost a game because Jacob Kurtz got a rebound and tipped it into his own basket. I mean, like, you know, okay. So that was Billy's last team. Blanco, first team, 35th. So Blanco's first team, which everybody likes to hate on, 35th in KenPom overall. Blanco's second team, 5th, Elite Eight, right? Number 5 in KenPom. Not a fluke team. third team, 22nd. They led the country in quad one wins. I'm not doing this to compare Blanco and Golden. I'm just saying, what should the expectations be at Florida? And what do you think of a 10-4 Florida team right now? Okay, so that's the third year. Fourth year is when Blanco's team start to fall off a little bit, but still 26th in KenPom, right? And you can't, like, make a ton of – it's all Billy Donovan's players year four because they played a bunch of freshmen and won a game in the NCAA tournament. The next year, 32nd in KenPom, that was the team that everybody had – everybody, a lot of people had in the Final Four before the season. Okay, still 32nd, so still better than this current Florida team. Then they go to 59th, and that's a – sorry, I skipped the season. 59th was Blanco's last team. 41st was his second-to-last team, the one that lost to Oral Roberts. So, you know, you see how they finally fell off to 44th, first, and 59th. And then obviously Florida last year wasn't remotely near those numbers, but – so that's concerning. And then just the losing thing, like Florida lost again. I thought Florida played good, not great. I thought that there were some of the signs that they're getting better, but they lost another game. They lost another quad one game. They don't have a quad one win. And some people sent me some random numbers. So I just went back and looked at them. They were like, yeah, Golden's 2-16 against KenPom top 100. So I said, that can't be right. So I went back and looked at it, and Golden is 6-21 against KenPom top 100. So every single loss he's had at Florida has been to a KenPom top 100 team. He's also only beaten 6 of them. And that's just not good enough.
Yeah, also just so people know, because I also just like pointed this out on – again, sometimes I give some of the Gator Country subscribers grief on this podcast. Hopefully none of it gets to them. So everyone, you know, keep this to yourselves. But like, you know, I pointed out that like in the net, also I should point out while I'm talking about where Florida dropped to, they were 48th in the net. They lose to Kentucky. They're 49th this morning. So that just also tells you like, it wasn't like it was some crazy loss that was going to drop them a ton. But, you know, I mentioned that in an article talking about how like, hey, 48th is like a little bit concerning. Obviously, there is a lot of games left, nearly the entire SEC. But like 48 is going to be like that is outside the bubble material right there. And a lot of people were like, oh, 48 puts you in comfortably, because I think that they like genuinely think that like it's 1-64 and they don't understand how one bid leagues work. But like, just so I say this just as an example, just in case any of those Gator Country people are listening to this podcast. So like 37th in KenPom last year. Well, I'll say, you know, I've been talking about they were 35th going. So 35th last year was Illinois. They were a 9 seed. 36 was Penn State. They were a 10 seed. 37th was Boise State, who was a 10 seed. I'll also point out that 34th was Virginia, who was a 4 seed. They were considered fraudulent by nearly everyone. They played Furman in that 4-13 game. And I believe more like in those like betting markets, like, every single person who bet on that game bet on Furman, and Furman won. So you know, that just shows right there, everyone, when you're doing your brackets, make sure that you don't see a four seed that's 34th in KenPom, because they're probably fraudulent. So Illinois was 35th in KenPom. They were a 9 seed. They beat UCLA, who was 3rd in KenPom, and Texas, who was 5th in KenPom in non-conference play, in addition to some good wins in Big Ten play. Penn State was an analytics darling all year. They didn't have great wins, but they actually beat Illinois in non-conference play. So that was their big one. And then they didn't have any bad losses. And then Boise State, again, without any huge opportunities, but they beat Texas A&M in non-conference play by 15. If you remember that game, this, you know, Texas A&M, that was pretty good. They also beat Colorado on a neutral floor. And they beat Washington State. So they had some high major wins. So, you know, you could look at these teams that were 9, 10, and 10 seed. It's like, well, last year, and like, it's like those teams have potentially better wins than Florida right now. You could argue that Florida's in that mix, but like, okay, congratulations. Florida is on pace with teams that were 10 seeds last year,
right?
That were last four. So like, that's just the current trajectory, obviously a ton left. But it's just, I really am happy to see so much enthusiasm. Like, again, Mike White,
that's great.
When Florida was on the bubble, Mike White did not have people defending him. I would still say, like, while there are people quite unhappy with Todd Golden, the majority of people I see, a heavy majority, are supporters and are big fans of this team. And there's a number of reasons why, for sure. Style of play and attitude and everything like that. But it's just one of those things that's like, should this be the case? I sent this to Neil before the Kentucky game. I'm sure people who listen to this podcast, some will also listen to the CBS Eye on College Basketball podcast, one of the biggest national podcasts. They were picking games on the Saturday, and it came up, and it was like Kentucky versus Florida. You know, who you got, Gary Parrish? And Gary Parrish is like, I don't think we have said one word about Florida this entire season. And this is like, again, I talk about this on the podcast often, and I often get pushback when I talk about the fact that Florida has not been nationally relevant for many years now. Like, there's one of the biggest college basketball podcasts, and the only reason they said a word about Florida for the first time in the season in January was because they were playing Kentucky. Like,
right.
You know, so like, if that doesn't tell you where Florida is, you know, nationally, like that, I mean, not that looking at one national podcast is...
Well, there was the Rothstein tweet too, which like...
Hey, Rothstein's in on the Gators at least.
Yeah, like I felt like state media because I felt like North Korean media because I like quote tweeted the Rothstein tweets because Rothstein said, oh, Florida has a chance to be nationally relevant again if they beat Kentucky. But this is what this is a game Todd Golden's been building for really for a year and a half, 2 years. And like, you know, so I felt like that's what I meant. I felt like state media because I was like, Florida never stopped being nationally relevant. No team's beaten Kentucky more since integration. Like this cool stat that I have. And it's like, that's all true, Neil, you know, talking to myself here on Florida Basketball Hour. But Kentucky has now won like 10 of 11 against Florida.
Like, yeah. And again,
this rivalry is not a thing right now.
Yeah, and I think that stat is really interesting, but it almost goes back to our blue blood conversation of the last podcast, where it's like, that's all well and good that Florida has beaten Kentucky more since integration than anyone else in the league. But it's like, you know, you mentioned you saw some pretty good high school recruits at the game.
Yeah.
Well, okay, since those guys have probably paid attention to college basketball, Florida's 1-10 or whatever. Like, you know, what is it? You know, if we hit them with the since integration stats, will that help his recruitment? Like, maybe we should try, but you know, it's just one of those things that, like,
right?
It's if we circle back, and this is just the case for Florida all year, and they're just not able to get the big wins, then this Kentucky game is just going to be one more game where you know, they just couldn't get it done, couldn't get the big win, couldn't figure out how to get a good shot at the end of the game, and then it's also one of those ones that if Florida turns it around, we can look back and say like, oh, well, Florida lost by 2 to the 18th ranked KenPom team or wherever they finish. But I think, like I said, I think they're going to be pretty good. They might be even getting even better. I don't know if you have more you want to talk about specifically about this game, Neil, but I did want to throw this to you because, again, I was talking about how, it was two thoughts. First of all, I think the two best players in the game, the two best guards for sure, but I'll say the two best performers were Walter Clayton and Zion Pullen. It's crazy to have the two best guards, maybe even the two best players in that game, and lose. That's what kind of happened to Florida. And then, you know, the response to someone who's maybe a casual fan will be like, oh, well, you know, I bet Kentucky dominated the front court because that's what Kentucky does. And it's like, oh no, Florida had the best guards and Kentucky's front court wasn't very good. Although it was, I kind of thought, oh, Kentucky's front court isn't very good. Florida's front court's going to dominate. That was not really the case. So did that surprise you at all? Or what was your kind of reaction to what seems like the first Tari Samuel quiet game in a long, long while. And just, you know, not being able to take advantage of a Kentucky front court that maybe you saw something different live, but man, I did not think was very good.
No, it was unfortunate. So I'll start with the front court and kind of work backwards. The front court stuff was unfortunate. There was, you know, Micah Hanlockton had the 6 offensive rebounds. I thought he played pretty well on both ends. But again, you saw how limited he is offensively. I mean, there was one possession where he got the ball on a post up, and it was comically bad, the shot he took and the move he made. It was really bad. so he just has so far to go as an offensive player. And, you know, I mean, Todd Golden kind of he referenced the Aaron Bradshaw 3. And I thought Todd was totally right that, like, if Aaron Bradshaw makes that 3, you kind of tip your hat to him. I totally agree with that part of Todd's statement, so I want to parse it really quickly. But I did not agree that he said, well, we put Aaron Bradshaw in the Micah Hanlockton category. Like, no. We do not. Aaron Bradshaw is, I don't want to say light years, but he is far ahead of where Micah Hanlockton is offensively, and he's in his 6th college game. Mike is in year 2. So I thought that was one thing that was certainly surprising. And then the other thing that was really surprising to me, I'm not going to get into too much into the big that Kentucky had, like, played almost never, whose name is escaping me. He had the
Onyensu.
Yeah. Onyensu had like the NBA traveling dunk where, I mean, I guess Florida lost by 2. So it kind of sucks that they didn't call that. Cause everyone on the Florida bench lost their mind. And Jay Billis was not far away from where we were. And you could see him go, like, you're not allowed to catch the ball and run 5 steps and dunk. Like, I don't. It was a tough one for Terry Oglesby. But not why Florida lost. Trey Mitchell for the 2nd straight year just ate Florida alive. And, I just was so surprised that Tyrese Samuel was just not able to sort of operate with him. And that Florida's also was unable to get, like, there's a couple times Florida couldn't even get entry passes to Tyrese Samuel. Like, either Mitchell read them or Kentucky's length, like, created real problems with ball denial or whatever it was. Like, he was just such a non-factor. And then obviously, I mean, Kentucky put 2 bodies on him whenever Florida put a shot up from deep and kind of said, like, we think we can 1v1 Micah Hanlockton. And so Hanlockton gets 6 offensive rebounds. But Florida only got 11, which is well under their season average. Florida needs those because they're not running good offense at the end of games. So that's my take on the front court. I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on what I just said.
Yeah, I didn't know that Bradshaw quote. I mean, like, and again, this is hard because, like, take any highly recruited front court player and there's going to be someone there who's like, oh, and they actually have potential as a stretch 5. Like, you hear that about everyone and few are. I will say that Bradshaw had quite a reputation as a pick and pop 3-point shooter coming out of high school. And I know it's so tough to prepare for high level freshmen because you don't have the kind of sample size to know. So like, I'm probably on the side of like, yeah, you just, if he makes that shot, you tip your hat to him. But yeah, it's also like, yeah, I think he's shown a little bit more pedigree than Micah Handlocked in from an offensive standpoint. But I did think, and again, maybe I have to watch the game again, but like, I know a lot of people were like, wow, like Tyrese Samuel really struggled. Like I just don't even remember him touching the ball. Like, you know, I remember once Florida throwing it out of bounds, trying to
passes.
And there was one, they threw it out of bounds. People thought Samuel was held. I didn't. I thought it was just the timing was off. But yeah, I'm just not sure that Florida made much of an effort to throw it into the bigs. And at one hand, it's like, well, Zion Pullen and Walter Clayton played fantastic basketball games. And our biggest issue with Florida offensively wasn't what they did for 37 minutes. It was what they did for the final 3 minutes. So, and, you know, playing through the post at the end of games is a challenge. So, you know, maybe it's just that he got, you know, game scripted out. I know most people's fantasy football seasons are finished, but everyone knows what it's like to have a talented running back game scripted out. Maybe that's the case, but it's certainly one of those situations where I think you just look back at the box score and the point total for Tyrese Samuel. And you look at these Kentucky bigs and you're like, oh man, like you kind of thought that was going to be a big advantage for the Gators. And, you know, there was also a game where Tyrese Samuel, who, you know, is listed at 6'10", I think he might be a little bit shorter. He's long, but he's physical, and these kind of skinnier 7'1" Kentucky bigs, I thought maybe there would be a good advantage for Florida to go at. And, but yeah, wasn't the case, but, so that was, you know, something to watch. I mean, Samuel's been just so consistent this year. It's hard to imagine him having another quiet one in a row, but, yeah, that was certainly a takeaway from a lot of fans as well.
Yeah, my other take on front court, like I think Zion Pullen was the best player in the game for sure. I thought DJ Wagner was the second best player in the game. And I only think that because of the second half, of course. I thought it was interesting that DJ Wagner was -9 in the first half and ended the game +1. Whatever you think of plus minus, but that's fine. But that's interesting. And then it makes sense. I mean, he had 2 points, a turnover, and no rebounds, no assists in the first half. And then he has 3 rebounds, 3 assists, 12 points to lead all scorers in the second half. And he had the savviness to trust his like high school teammate to make that shot, which I'm sure that for DJ Wagner, who kind of was getting what he wanted downhill towards the rim, you know, it must have been tempting as a 18-year-old kid to kick the ball, to just take the ball to the rack, right? And that's not what happened. I mean, he pitches it back, and Bradshaw makes the shot. I mean, that's as loud as it was, that's a really heady play by a young player. And it contrasts with, like, the play that Pullen made because he got frustrated, right? Like, pretty nicely. So to me, like, yeah, I thought Pullen and DJ Wagner were the best players. And Walter did what he does sometimes, which is because he's not streaky. Like every shot he takes in person looks like it's going in. I've seen him 3 times now. You know, it's beautiful. But when Florida went 1 for 10 from beyond the arc in the second half, Todd said he thought they got a lot of good looks. I thought they got some, not a lot. But yeah, I mean, Walter didn't make many shots right in the second half. He had one beautiful drive where he got fouled by two players and like kind of skidded on the floor after. And it was a really late whistle. And I think he wondered if they were going to call it. And he was like on the floor when they blew the whistle. And that was pretty. And then he hit the free throws, which I'm sure I asked for some listener questions. We got a bunch of free throw ones. And it's like, I have a take on it, but so that was kind of my take on backcourt players.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I like you said, I think it's hard when like DJ Wagner had the like better second half, but Walter Clayton, and it feels like, I don't know if this might be a little anecdotal. I haven't totally looked at the numbers, but it feels like Walter Clayton has had a lot better first half than second halves. And I don't say that as like, wow, he needs to, you know, kick, he needs to keep his focus in the second half. Right. I just think it's like, it's, I'm more saying that as it's like impressive that he seems to be the one who's like ready to go from the jump and has kind of fueled a bunch of Florida leads in the first half. So, but again, it's like, we kind of know that when the game's tight, those second half possessions matter extra. And it's not that Clayton was bad as much as that you saw a little bit why Wagner was such a sought after recruit and why Louisville would try to make some hires just to get that guy and ultimately not get him. And, you know, it's a whole different story. I think that might be all I have to that one. Yeah. I mean, now that you said there's listener questions, I don't know if we need to throw to that or if you have any kind of final takes. No. I think I said my kind of final takes on this one is what I said earlier.
Yeah.
Florida proved once again that they appear to be the roughly 35th best team in the country. And, that might get them into the NCAA tournament as a 9 or 10 seed. And that certainly beats not making it. But I would be disappointed with that, given what I thought this team was going into the season.
Yeah. So I'll share my final takeaway and I have permission to share it. And I think you probably know what I'm going to tell people. Cause I told Eric this already as I was leaving the Diodome, just texted him a couple things. I mean, I saw Jay Billis, who I've gotten to talk to a few times and, you know, I just said, hey, what do you think? You know, what do you think of this team? And he said, well, they have a lot of pros. And he said, I don't know if they have NBA pros other than maybe Kugel, who eventually could be an NBA player. He said, but I think they have a bunch of guys that are going to play a long time. And he said, I haven't seen Condon, so I can't say, but he said, everything that, you know, you see on film is good. He said, so they have a lot of pros. They're good. He said, they're a good team. He said, they're also underachieving. He said, they should not be 10-3. And that was kind of his take. And I don't think Florida should be 10-3. I don't think they should be 10-4. Doesn't mean I don't think they're getting better. I really genuinely believe they're getting better. Like, I think you can point to what I pointed to, which is that either they didn't work hard enough to get Samuel involved, or because he couldn't get offensive rebounds, he wasn't involved. But either way, they got nothing from two of the guys who you could argue have been two of their three best players this season, Tyrese Samuel and Will Richard. And they lost to Kentucky by 2, you know, and led for 30 minutes. But Florida has to start closing some of these games. And they need to do it soon if they want to go to the NCAA tournament. And I think if they don't go to the NCAA tournament this year, then we have harder conversations. That's my takeaway from the Kentucky game.
Yeah, that sounds about it. Happy you got to see Bielis. Always, that was the one thing, talking about, you know, Florida's, you know, national relevancy or whatever, like to get Shulman and Bielis on a game, like that's the best. Shulman is especially, I'm also so lucky that the Blue Jays, you know, signed coveted free agent Shulman away from the Dodgers. So he calls Blue Jays games in the summer, which is the perfect background to watching film. So I think he's great. So it's good to have that kind of good to have those guys in the O-Dome covering the team. But you hope that becomes the case once again. But I also just wanted to say, you know, and you mentioned on Twitter too, like, hey, shout out to the fans at the O-Dome who made it feel special. There's a couple of rowdies who were tweeting out the night before the game some kind of concerning things. I don't know if you saw this, Neil, that there was only a couple people camped out, and the people that were camped out were like, hey, what's going on? And there's maybe it was suggested that they were told not to camp out, which of course was a you know, just when
that's
Florida,
weird.
Yeah, just when things were humming, that was such a standby. So, whatever it took, maybe there wasn't as many people camped out, but the rowdies were absolutely there and loud when the game started, and it wasn't just them. It was everyone. So it's great to see the building rocking, and it is great to see, despite the fact there's a tough loss, and it still seems like enthusiasm's quite high, and sounds like Florida's next game is going to be a good atmosphere as well at home.
Yeah, there's only 200 tickets left, and that was as of Saturday afternoon. So, you know, only a couple hundred tickets from another sellout against a schizophrenic Arkansas team. So, you know, you never know which version of the must bus will show up. Could be the one that beat Duke, could be the one that had the worst home loss in their history of their program. Who knows? Life is a mystery in the Southeastern Conference. LSU routed A&M and College Station this weekend. Who knows what is happening, Eric? I don't want to do listener questions now because, like, in fact, I think I'm going to make it a Patreon. And, you know, maybe Eric and I can do a Patreon episode, which is long overdue anyway. People should join our Patreon because we got so many and we're 43 minutes in. And I want to talk about Ole Miss, which is Wednesday night at 9 o'clock Eastern. So perfect faucet time. A little late for an old guy like me over here on the East Coast. No, it's good though, because my foray into coaching U10 basketball has been okay. So let me tell you guys first of all that, like, when you coach high level high school basketball, like, this isn't Edmonton Stingers or anything that Fawcett's done, but like when you coach like high level high school basketball for multiple years. And you're at like the City of Palms and you're at, you know, the Villages tournament or wherever the hell you are. And then you're coaching U10s and you realize like you can basically give them one command, maybe two if you're lucky. And then the attention span is just totally gone. And so it's the craziest thing. I mean, I'm having a lot of fun with the Charlotte Sports Foundation. They needed coaches and my bleeding heart, Bleeding Heart signed up, but our practices are Wednesday nights. And I'm like, hey, man, if the Gators want to play all 9 o'clock games, that's beautiful, because otherwise I'm going to miss some first halves. But 9 o'clock in Oxford, where Ole Miss has been really good this year. You just mentioned, I'm glad you brought up the net stuff and like, hey, they've got to win over this team. Like, so people have been making fun of like Ole Miss's schedule a little bit. And like, I get it, but they also have a win over NC State, who I think is pretty good. And they have a win over Memphis, who I know is pretty good. And both those games were in Oxford. Like, those are two wins that are better than any win Florida has.
Yeah, that's it is funny you mention that. There are some people that I quite like that are Florida fans and quite like interacting with them on Twitter, but they were, you know, slinging a lot of mud at the Ole Miss schedule and the strictest schedule. And I was like, I'm pretty sure they have better wins than Florida right now. So, yeah, it's and again, it's one of those things that I do think for these first year coaches at high major jobs, it's like the easiest cheat code to relevancy is just to play an easier schedule. And even if Chris Beard played a really weak schedule, or played the schedule they did that is pretty weak, and lost to NC State and Memphis, people would still be saying, hey, you know, like they dropped those ones, but like, hey, in the first year rebuild, like things are going pretty well. So it is unfortunately a very wise thing to do for first year coaches at high major programs. And then, yeah, if you beat the crap out of these bye games, like, well, hey, you're still going to do fine in the net. So yeah, Chris Beard is at Ole Miss. I'm disappointed by it. We don't need to talk about it.
Yeah, it sucks.
Much, but it's a little bit of something that makes me feel uncomfortable about a sport I love. The other thing that is, you know, I'm not as offended by this as I am about Chris Beard being on the sideline. But you know, Chris Beard was the one who took a couple of two-time transfer guys that had no business, like no reasonable argument for why they should be eligible, in Brandon Murray, who was at LSU and then Georgetown, now at Ole Miss, and then Musa Cisse, who is at Memphis, transferred to Oklahoma State, now at Ole Miss. Both guys that had no justification for a two-time waiver. Chris Beard is one of the guys who's like, well, I'm going to take these guys anyways and put in a waiver process. And as we know, these two-time waiver guys are now eligible. And yeah, that is two impactful players. I think that Brandon Murray is I'm hesitant to call guys losing players, but Brandon Murray plays a low efficiency style of basketball for two teams in the past that have lost a lot of games. So it makes me question the viability of him being on a good team, but he's also a wing with size who can go get a bucket from time to time. And then you've got Musa Cisse, who is a 7 foot. Well, this is actually funny. I mean, depending on, you know, because he's been at three programs, you might see 6'10", you might see 7'1", you might see 7 feet. But you know, he is a big man, and however big he is, he plays extremely physically. Not much of an offensive game, but he doesn't, you know, he's not going to be out there taking mid-range jump shots or trying to post up. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he's just kind of a big body, great, outstanding rebounder, one of the best in the country last year. And yeah, so that is two impactful guys. So it was one of those things where they started playing a relatively weak schedule. They were able to get some of those wins, like you mentioned. And then they kind of got the cavalry coming in with Brandon Murray becoming eligible and then Moussa Cisse. I do think you've got a roster that is pretty solid. And as much as Chris Beard off the court is someone I do not admire, I do think he has shown the ability at multiple programs to be very competitive right away. And it kind of looks like that is the case at Ole Miss. You know, it's going to be in tough with their current, you know, resume situation and or what the metrics would suggest right now, be pretty difficult for them to get into the NCAA tournament, but it's certainly possible. And it's going to be an interesting one for sure on Saturday. But Chris Beard has shown the ability to really coach his guys up, find advantages. And there's a reason that Ole Miss was willing to hire him despite the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And, you know, that Memphis team they beat is good, man. They have Caleb Mills, Javon Quinterly, David Jones. I mean, they're like a portal super team. And they, you know, they beat them, and they kind of did what Chris Beard teams sometimes do, which is they take a while to figure you out. But once they figure you out, they just hammer at your weakness over and over. And, you know, that's one thing. And the other thing Chris Beard teams do is, like, they, you know, they're shot quality kings. And I don't mean that from, like, the shot quality metric. I mean, they just don't take a ton of bad shots. They're very smart with the shots that they take. Their three-point shooting is, like, the perfect example because it tracks, like, so many Texas Tech teams where, like, they shoot 40% from deep and then they're, like, 295th or something in three-pointers taken. And it's like, that's because they take open ones, man. You know, like, it's because they take good shots and they're very patient offensively. And then, you know, while a guy like Brandon Murray might not be a winning player, they have guys like, you know, Jamon Brakefield, who I think really is a winning player, who does everything well. Alan Flanagan, I think, is a winning player. Was surprised that he left Auburn. But, you know, he's a guy who really, really can guard. I think he can play in the NBA because he can guard. I don't know how good he is. I don't think that's a terribly excruciating hot take. Like, I think he could find a role in the NBA because he's so good defensively. Now, do I think he is a great offensive player? No, but he's taking better shots this year, right? Like, he's only taking 23 three-pointers as opposed to at Auburn where he was just letting it fly all the time. And he's doing things that, you know, he's good at. He's attacking closeouts. He's getting to the free throw line. He shot 83 free throws, which is third in the SEC in attempts. And then they have a rim protector in Jamarion Sharp, who is, you know, a much better rim protector so far than Micah Hanlockton has been, while about as limited, if not more limited, than Hanlockton is offensively. You know, so when he's in, he's not there to score. So they're going to use their wings to score. Matt Morrell and Flanagan. And now they have Murray. Both the Murrays are guys that can score it a little bit. Jalen Murray, who I think is the Butler transfer. So they've got some guys that can score. But mainly they're it's just wings and really good shots. Right. And again, they have two better wins than Florida has. So if Florida's on the bubble and Ole Miss is on the bubble and the SEC is an ex-bid league, this becomes a really immense basketball game.
Jalen Murray was on the St. Peter's teams was kind of a funny, I just wanted to shout it out just because people might be like, oh, I remember that from, you know, one of the more fun teams recently. And like, it was also like a funny concept to me. Like, to me, he's not a SEC level guy, like maybe not really a high major guy, but I thought it was like a somewhat funny concept to be like, hey, do we bring in maybe someone who can be a high major killer with like a Purdue. So, Where was I on picking up? Oh, Jamarian Sharp too. I just wanted to note Jamarian Sharp. For also those of people who might not know, he is 7'5". So he will jump off the screen when he comes off. And I actually think, of course, everyone knows the Gators got Olivier Rioux, that 7'7" or whatever, IMG kid from Montreal. That will be like a preferred walk-on next year. Like, I almost thought that the breadcrumbs were laid when the Gators actually went after Jamarian Sharp in the transfer portal. I don't know how seriously, but it was, you know, notable to me that they did at least have some contact with Sharp, who was at Western Kentucky, and then you know, later ended up signing the 7'7" kid from IMG. So there's certainly some interest that the Gators have with these super tall players. And I guess we'll see some of the viability of them throughout SEC play with Sharp. But yeah, it's one of those rosters that I don't think they've got like a stud. I don't think they have a star. I mean, Matthew Morrell has been like steadily getting better in that role throughout his kind of career, but I do look at everyone and it's like, oh, this is like a solid player. Oh, this is like a good solid player. Like, oh, like Jamin Brakefield, Adel Fanagan, just like continually solid SEC guys.
Yeah, right.
So like everyone is rock solid, but again, I think there was a lot of people that were, calling fraud to Ole Miss's schedule early, and you know, they were undefeated until their first game of SEC play. And I think there's a lot of people who are like, oh, no, this seems like nowhere near as good. And then they played Tennessee. And of course, Tennessee's really good. But like, it seemed like 5 minutes into the game, it was decided. And it was like, well, yeah, Ole Miss is losing this one. And, you know, it was like, it felt like 30 minutes of the game was garbage time. The final score was only Tennessee by like 26. But, you know, it was a decisive win for Tennessee. So this is kind of Ole Miss's opportunity to play a team that's like, and again, I don't think anyone had expectations of Ole Miss being an NCAA tournament team, except for like maybe Chris Beard, because he does win seemingly wherever he goes. But it's one of those things that's like, well, like if they are going to surprise everyone and be an NCAA tournament team right away, it's like, well, it's the Floridas of the SEC that they're going to need to win games like that, particularly at home. Yeah, Ken Pom has this one as a 2-point Gators win. So it's, you know, it could be close. I don't know if we'll be in the habit of saying the Ken Pom projected score every single game, but hey, Ken Pom was 1 point off predicting the exact score against Kentucky. So I think Ken Pom has earned the right to have the score pointed out once again. Ken Pom has it a 80-78 win for the Gators. And that looks a whole lot like a one possession game. And Florida needs to show that they have the ability to win those one possession games against, again, a coach in Chris Beard, who has quite a reputation, at least as someone who coaches pretty well in those situations.
Yeah, no, he's great at it. You know, there's a reason that he went from, you know, kind of relative obscurity to maybe getting one of the top 10 at Arkansas Little Rock to like maybe one of the top 10 jobs in the sport, right? Like, you know, at Texas. And that looked like it was going to be the type of, you know, wedding that was going to bring Texas what Florida got, which was dual sport national titles. I mean, that was going to happen. I don't think Chris Beard should be coaching college basketball. I think it's a kind of shameful testament to the will, not just the will to win, but the will to win at any cost in the SEC, that he's on a sideline. I think it's also kind of sad that Ole Miss is willing to kind of whore itself to Chris Beard, quite honestly, who is just going to use that as a stepping stone to another big job. You know, a lot of this is horrible. The reason I think Florida will win is because Ole Miss does not really have a point guard. And I think that is problematic against this Florida team. I do think that that's kind of the one thing you really do need to have against Florida, whether it's Reese Beekman. You don't necessarily need an All-American, but like everyone that's beaten Florida has been okay at that position. and, you know, and then in the Kentucky game, whether it was Reed Shepard or DJ Wagner, they made enough plays in the second half to kind of figure it out. So, I don't know. I mean, like you said, the guy that they have to do it has been to the Elite Eight, right? So, but he was a backup, and you know, he was not prepared for the Zakai Ziegler Tennessee backcourt. Now that was in Knoxville. They're back at home. They'll be more comfortable. And they're going to be kind of a wounded animal because they just got crushed. And, you know, so they should, you should expect them to be fired up to play Florida. But the Gators should be jacked too, man. Like, they need to start winning these games. So should be an interesting one on the SEC Network Wednesday night, Eric.
Yeah, and as is something else that we just have to talk about it every opponent. It is notable in this case, but Florida, of course, is an offensive rebounding team. That is seemingly their identity.
Yeah.
Ole Miss has rebounded very poorly. They're 318th in the country in defensive rebounding percentage. They're also 229th in the country in offensive rebounding percentage. Of course, well, on one hand, it's like, well, they're missing Musa Cisse for a bunch of those games. On the other hand, they have not played many good teams. And therefore, you would think that their offensive rebounding numbers would be, or defensive rebounding numbers would be much better, because again, those are not adjusted numbers. So given the low quality of competition that Ole Miss has played, you'd think their rebounding numbers would be better. So definitely some concern. Musa Cisse was seventh in the country in defensive rebounding percentage last year at Oklahoma State. So like, he has shown the ability to be a good defensive rebounder, but it's hard for one guy to make that much like a huge difference on the glass. So it could be just another situation where the Gators could potentially win a game with their ability to offensive rebound. And I think Florida would be happy to, while they'd love to execute at a really high level offensively and hit a bunch of shots, that would be fantastic. I think they'd be more than happy to, they would certainly sign up for just another offensive rebounding
for sure,
clobbering. So that's, you know, of course, something to watch for.
I'm glad you brought it up, because I was totally gonna, like, I even wrote it down and I was gonna go the whole show and forget it. I mean, yeah, NC State gave up 18 offensive boards, or NC State got 18 and then shot 3 of 25 from three. So that's how they lost by 20 at the TAD. And then Memphis had 16 offensive boards. They shot terrible from three and lost. But Tennessee, they got 19 and they were at home and they made everything the other day. So that also helped. But yeah, I mean, they're going to give up a lot of offensive rebounds to Florida because they do not rebound well. I mean, and that was the deal last year. Like, Jamon Brakefield was their best rebounder. And remember, like, when Castleton got hurt, Florida was up by, what, they were up by a lot, right? Yeah, it was 20, 25 points. Castleton probably should have been sitting on the bench. I mean, you know, all kinds of stuff going down there. But, so Florida's going to get those. And I think you're right. This is league play. Like, you grind them out any way you can. And John Calipari, for all his flaws, is no dummy. And, like he said, hey, Florida's just going to – they're going to physically grind out some wins in this league. It's one thing that he said the other day that I think is totally true. This would be a place to do that. Especially because, like, as I mentioned, like, the league favorite lost at home to LSU, the preseason league favorite. The other preseason league favorite is Tennessee. They look like they could win the SEC again, maybe even going away. But other than that, like, it's kind of – there's just a lot of traffic from like spots 3 to 10. And this is one of those games that helps separate. So I'll let Eric sign us off. Go ahead.
Oh, I have one more question before you pre-close it out or close it out entirely. Did you see that Ben Brandon, who covers SEC basketball, he did a composite of the quality of competition per Ken Pom and Evan Mia and Bartorvik and one more that I'm getting, and that the Gators have the easiest non-conference schedule, or sorry, easiest conference schedule. Of course, the SEC with the number of teams does not have a balanced schedule. And every year there are teams that get the benefit. I called it in the offseason. I did not know it was going to be this drastic, but I did think that the Gators got a very favorable schedule. Thank you to Ben Brandon, who now has the numbers to support it. It's interesting when, like you said, it just seems like there's going to be a whole lot of teams fighting in the middle of the SEC. The Gators could get a break with one of the easier schedules.
Well, and that's why these games are important. Like Florida could very well get that 11 or 12 win mark in league play. And I say that because, I know that it's been kind of probably a discouraging show, but that was a discouraging loss. And I don't think we've sugarcoated anything on this pod at any point in time that we've had the show. So I'm glad you brought that up because Ben did send that to me. And I think I may have tweeted it out. I may have liked it. I don't remember. But, you know, then I looked at it and I was like, man, after Auburn visits Florida on February 10th, like Alabama is the only resume opportunity. If things hold for the entire final month of the season. Like if things hold the way they are now, one eye open on Blanco because they mauled Missouri. That game was not as close as that score. And they have a win over Wake. And they're just Blancoing their way through the year. I wouldn't be surprised if they Blanco their way to 20 dubs. But right now, the only resume opportunity is Alabama after the Auburn game on February 10th. So if Florida can weather this first month and then do what Todd Golden has done at Florida, which is beat the teams he should beat, then, you know, they can take advantage of that, Eric.
Yeah, it was just a good when talking about the fact that they're going to need to take care of business in games like this where they are favored against Ole Miss. It was just also a thing like I think a lot of people can point to a lot of things that have been bad luck for the Gators in recent years, and I would agree with a lot of them. But it's like, well, here's an opportunity where the Gators really got a very, very, very favorable break, in my opinion, because, yeah, in an unbalanced schedule league, like the difference between playing one of the four top schedules and what the Gators playing is massive. And I think when you look back, there's some coaches who got a really, really raw deal. Andy Kennedy, notably, a number of times in a row. Fox at Georgia, like some of those times when you look back at these like quote-unquote disappointing years, and then you look at how much more difficult their SEC schedule was than other teams. And I think everyone knows, and like everyone is conditioned to look at non-conference schedules, and they know to look for quality of competition and who are you playing. I don't think that people think enough about, oh, the SEC does not have balanced schedules, and they're often not even particularly close. Look at the teams that the Gators get to play twice this year, as they're like, whatever, not regular rivalries, but otherwise, versus some of the, like, again, it really breaks favorable. And it's also something, again, we don't need to talk about this anymore, but of course, when the Gators are adding more teams, when Oklahoma and Texas come, it's like, well, that is only going to be spotlighted even more. The schedules are going to be drastically different between the harder and least hard kind of schedules in the SEC. So it's another thing. If you're looking for optimism about the Gators, you could say, well, look, they have the schedule set up to do some damage.
Yeah. And before Malik sends me a message, cause I know he'll listen to the end of the show. Shout out to Malik, saying that I skipped South Carolina on the road as a resume opportunity. Like, if you're going to throw shade at Ole Miss's schedule, then please don't. And now this isn't directed at Malik. This is just directed at general populace. please click on South Carolina's schedule so far. I love Lamont Paris. I love Eddie Shannon. Look, those guys are awesome, man. Like, I'm wishing them all the best. I hope they go 25-2 or whatever. But, like, they have no good wins. Done. Miss State is their best win. Hey, way to open league play with a dub, you know. But that is their best win right now. Like, otherwise, there is nothing that they've done that's impressive. And the only good team they played in conference play, in non-conference, they lost. So, like, you know. And we're not like throwing stones at glass houses right here at Florida, because I think, you know, Florida's best win right now is a iffy win over Pitt, right? Or, well, it was a good win over an iffy Pitt team, I should say. But, like, that's it, man. So, you know, I don't know. I'll let Eric sign us off here, though.
Yeah, I try not to criticize people for doing something that I would do. And I will say, if I was in the situation of South Carolina, year two of Lamont Paris coming off the first year they did, I would probably schedule the exact same way, to be quite honest with you. And hey, I don't know where they're at in the net. I should look, but you know, they're 57th in KenPom, which again is not in at large consideration, but hey, then you go to the SEC and you see what happens. So
they're 40th in the net because they've been blowing everybody out.
Hey, there's another good net lesson right there. But yeah, we let's hope Florida can be a team blowing someone out on Saturday against Ole Miss. So go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.